This is program number 13 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. I hope that you have listened to the earlier presentations in this audio series, especially number 12, where we talked about the question of evolution, what the word evolution means, the fact that things do change, but that the amount of change that takes place and what has taken place is primarily revealed through the fossil record, and that there is nothing in the fossil record that conflicts with what the biblical record says, but there is material which is dealing with subjects where the biblical record is silent. And we will talk more about that in later presentations. What we're interested in this discussion is talking about where we go from that. We have seen that there is copious evidence that the dinosaurs existed. We have talked about everything from the discovery of dehydrated specimens to finding eggs with baby dinosaurs inside. We have talked about the fact that the conditions and the world in which the dinosaurs lived appears to be very different than the world in which we live. And we've even talked about the fact that by looking at coprolite, the excrement of dinosaurs, that we can tell what these animals ate and how they lived. When we start talking about when the dinosaurs lived, we get into a whole variety of new issues. One of the problems here is that there are many, many denominational groups that have a vested interest in this subject. Over half of all Protestant denominations, and even a greater number percentage-wise in what we would call conservative fundamentalist groups, have what is known as a dispensational view of the history of the earth. They believe the earth's history is broken down into roughly even 1,000-year periods, and I'm going to overgeneralize this because obviously there are many different opinions about how this is supposed to be set up. I frankly think they're all erroneous, but the fact of the matter is that there are differences. But generally speaking, historically, there were seven periods: the Innocence period, the Conscience period, the Civil Government period, the Patriarchal rule, the Mosaic law, the Grace period, and the Millennium. And these were all proposed to be roughly 1,000 years in length. The period we're living in now is supposed to end with something called the Rapture. And don't look for the word rapture in your Bible because it's not there. This is a view that says that all of the Christians would be swept off the earth and that Jesus would return and would recruit 144,000 Jews to be missionaries for Christ, and that these Jews would conduct a war with the opponents of the day. And some of this was concerning the Arabs, and some of it was concerned with Russia and China. And as political situations change, many times the enemy changes. But they all end up with the same thing, that eventually Jesus would return and set up, after a seven-year tribulation, a kingdom in Jerusalem restoring Jewish worship, and that Christ would rule on David's throne for 1,000 years. And you probably have heard bits and pieces of that. I know that's a major oversimplification, but I think it's important as we start talking about the age of the earth to understand that in a discussion like that, one of the issues that comes about is what is the purpose of the people that are promoting a particular age to the earth? If your denomination teaches that the history of the earth is broken down into 1,000-year periods, then you can't go much beyond 6,000 years. You can't go much beyond six of the dispensations. And that's where virtually all creationist groups are coming from. When you read things from Answers in Genesis, when you look at the Scofield Bible, when you get involved with Ken Ham's material, when you look at John Hagee or Paul Crouch or Pat Robertson or Jimmy Swigert or Hal Lindsey or Charles Ryer or John Wolvoord or Eric Sy, any of these very well-known TV figures, this is where they're coming from. I don't have that view. I find no doctrinal reason why it necessitates me coming up with any particular age to the earth. The question that we have been using from the very start in this discussion has been, what does the evidence show? What does the evidence show? And I think it's very important to understand that, first of all dating methods from a scientific standpoint are based upon a religion. And the religion is called uniformitarianism. Now, that's not Unitarianism. Unitarianism is something else. Uniformitarianism is the religious belief that nothing has ever happened in the history of the earth that is not going on right now. Now, I want to emphasize that we're talking about process here. The snappy way of saying it is the present is the key to the past. So when geologists look at the Earth, when evolutionists make interpretations to support their religious views or their naturalistic views, the present is the key to the past. Everything is explained in terms of erosion and volcanic eruptions and glaciation and earthquakes and tsunamis. And it doesn't mean that there necessarily are catastrophes. It just means that the processes are assumed to have always been the same. So that what has shaped the surface of the Earth and what we see in the rock record is understandable in terms of processes operational today. And here we have our first possible conflict with the Bible or with people's understanding of the Bible. The Bible says God is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, so it generally endorses a pretty much of a uniformitarian position. But it also presents the fact that there have been catastrophes in the history of the Earth, something not going on today. The most obvious example is the flood of Noah. Whatever interpretation you make of that, whether you think it's global or local, whatever you think the processes were, the point is the processes are not happening today. And that's our point here. So this religious view, this faith view, that the present is the key to the past, is the foundation of virtually all determinations of time. Now, one of the interesting facts here is that the evidence says that the uniformitarian view is not valid. Let me give you one example. There are probably 100, but let me give you one. Not too many years ago, a man by the name of Alvarez was doing research on the Cretaceous geological period. This is the period of time when the dinosaurs became extinct. And as he looked at the sediments in which the remains were found, he discovered that the sediments contained very unusual amounts of the elements iridium, osmium, and rhenium. Now you say, what? I never heard of that stuff. Well, that's not the normal material that makes up the Earth. I mean, we're familiar with things like carbon and oxygen and nitrogen, maybe iron, cobalt, nickel. In the periodic chart of the elements, where all the elements known to man are listed, rhenium, osmium, and iridium are down with tungsten and platinum and gold. There are elements 75, 76, and 77 in the periodic chart. Gold is 79, so it's down in that area. And these elements are found in the Earth's crust, but in very, very minor amounts. In the last remains of the dinosaurs, they are found in concentrations that are as much as 500 times greater than what is found in the normal crust of the Earth. And where do we find those elements in those concentrations? In asteroids. In large chunks of rock from outer space that have struck the Earth, in the geologic past, and have altered the Earth. What Alvarez found was that in these deposits there were massive concentrations of these elements. And about that same time, there was an interesting find made in Mexico, in the Yucatan Peninsula, where an impact crater was found that matched the time element of the extinction of the dinosaurs very, very well. It was not only good in terms of size, it was in a coastal area, and there was some evidence of the tsunami on the opposing side of the Gulf of Mexico. And there were large amounts of elements known as cenotes. Those are cryptocrystalline quartz, which is produced by very high pressure, very high temperature, even higher than in a volcano, only known to be produced by collisions of an astronomical nature. And they were in a debris pattern that fits the concept of an asteroid hitting the Earth, both in time and distribution and in the makeup of what took place in the area. It's very difficult not to believe that at the end of the Cretaceous geological period that a large asteroid hit the Earth and would have vaporized itself and part of the Earth's crust and produced a nuclear winter. Now, if that were the case, then that debris pattern, that field, should be evident not just in the Yucatan Peninsula and not just with the dinosaurs. And as a matter of fact, there was an extinction of many of the forms of life on the Earth. Phytoplankton were extincted, at least very numerous varieties of them, in the oceans. Now, that's a completely different thing. There was a large deposit of iridium, osmium, and so forth in that nuclear winter fallout all over the Earth. Since that time, there's been a find of a similar place in Sudbury, Ontario, with distribution patterns of debris several hundred miles located from the center. And it's important to understand here that this process is not operational today. We understand it. We are concerned about whether it might happen again, but we have not considered it to be a major player in the process of producing the geologic record as we see it. So uniformitarianism, the present is the key to the past, obviously is not universally true. And this is just one of many, many, many evidences. I have a list that has appeared in scientific journals of everything from the migration of the solar system across the galactic equator to supernova explosions, all kinds of changes that have happened in terms of the magnetic field of the Earth. And these are not things that radically affect the formation and development of life and the way that evolutionary process functions today. In this discussion, there's not much point in us going through all of these different areas. The important thing to understand is what the assumption is and the fact that there can be some pretty good challenges laid against that assumption. Now, what's interesting here is that as scientists have tried to reconstruct the history of the Earth, they have come up with something which is called the geologic time scale. This is an attempt to organize the history of the Earth as seen in the rock record in terms of the things that took place during that period of time. And let me just give you a local example. Where I live here in the southwest corner of Michigan, the rocks are Devonian in age. Devonian is one of the time periods in the geologic time scale. It's supposed to have happened between 245 and 550 million years ago. Why are the rocks called Devonian rocks? Well, they're called that, and that Devonian period is called the Age of the Fishes. Because when I take my kids on a field trip in our science class to the local gravel pit, what we find are the remains of fish. Not only fish, but things that support fish, sponges, corals, all kinds of marine creatures. We don't find any fossils of humans. We don't find any reptilian fossils, no mammal fossils, no amphibian fossils. It's pretty much all fish. So we call it the Age of the Fishes. And there are certain forms of life that when we see it in other places in the world, we assume is of the same age because it contains the same fossils. And when we date it by other methods, it does turn out to be the same. Now, there are different layers. If you go into Pennsylvania, for example, you're going to be in Mississippian deposits and you will see some amphibians. And that's called the Mississippian Pennsylvanian Age, the Age of the Amphibians. Some of you may be familiar with the movie Jurassic Park. The Jurassic time period is a period in the geologic time scale in which the dinosaurs dominated the Earth. Now, in the remains that we find dinosaurs, we also find some of those earlier forms. We find fish, we find amphibians, but we also find these huge animals called the dinosaurs. And so the movie Jurassic Park got its name from the Jurassic time period in the geologic time scale, which is supposed to be well over 66 million years ago, and is the period of time when the dinosaurs dominated the Earth. In my geology class, the professor used to jokingly say that we live in the obscene geologic period, the period of time when man screwed up the Earth. And, you know, you can get into all kinds of ecological discussions connected with that, but this is an attempt to organize the history of the Earth as seen in the rock record. Now, at this point, somebody might say, well, you know, okay, so that's the way that's put together, but how do they get those enormously long periods of time? I mean, I've been talking in terms of millions of years. How can that be? Well, let me give you an example of a dating method. I did this when I was working on my master's thesis. This is a place that was in northern Alaska. In Alaska, in the wintertime, it snows, duh. In the summertime, it doesn't snow, but it doesn't get very warm either, and so the snow in some places doesn't melt. And I was working in an area where the snow didn't melt in the summertime because it wasn't hot enough long enough to melt the snow. So what happens is the snow is exposed to the air, and the top of the snow gets very dirty. It gets covered with dust. It gets covered with pollen. It gets covered with insects, mosquitoes, grasshoppers, mayflies. Now, the next winter, it will snow again, and that layer will be covered up. So there will be a dark line, which, when you look at it under the microscope, will be full of dust and pollen and mosquitoes and grasshoppers and so forth. Then there'll be this layer of snow on top of it. On top of that layer of snow, we'll have another summer. And so there'll be more mosquitoes, grasshoppers, dust, pollen, etc. The next winter, more snow. Next summer, bugs next winter, snow, summer, winter, summer, winter. I sat in a trench and counted summer, winter, summer, winter, summer, winter for 6 solid weeks. That's the kind of thing graduate students do. And there were over 30,000 dirt lines in that cut. And you say, well, but that may have been volcanic eruptions or... No, you had to look at each layer to make sure it was a summer layer. Grasshoppers, etc. And I have never yet seen a volcano erupt grasshoppers. I think it's very difficult to argue with that kind of evidence. And that's just one of over 600 different methods based upon different assumptions used to determine the age of certain rocks and the age of certain formations. Now, in their attempts to try and explain their doctrinal needs to confine the age of the earth to 6 1,000-year periods, dispensationalists have resorted to things like the flood of Noah, and we'll talk about that very shortly. But the problem with that is that the explanations they have given are frequently horrific scientifically. The average seventh grader can see major problems in the claims that they are making. And if the preacher gets up and says that the Grand Canyon was produced by the flood and mentions these methods, and the seventh grader realizes that these methods absolutely are misrepresented, what happens to that child's faith? If the preacher's wrong on that, how do I know he's right on anything? And we create monstrous problems for children when that type of thing takes place. And I come back to the fact that it's unnecessary. There's no reason for us to use the Bible to try and establish the age of the earth. Now, somebody says at this point, well, you know, the fact is, though, that when you go through the Bible, you can go back and you can look at the way in which the age of the earth was calculated, and you can see that it gives a period of about 6,000 years. And my answer to that statement is, okay, well, where does it say that? What assumptions are made? We talked about the fact that uniformitarianism is the assumption of all of the different methods of dating, and we only talked about one, but we could have talked about radiometric dating or magnetic reversal dating or any of the other dating methods, because there are literally some 600 of them. So what assumptions are made here? And let me point out to you that probably historically this all started with a guy by the name of Archbishop James Usher, who lived from 1581 to 1656 and who was an Anglican primate of Ireland. And in 1650, he wrote a very scholarly piece on chronology. And what Usher did was that he stated a group of assumptions. For instance, he said, I'm going to assume that there are no undated verses in the Bible. Is that true? How long were Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? I have a male chauvinist friend who says, knowing my wife, it couldn't have possibly been more than 10 minutes. But that's an assumption. And it's an assumption that will get you in mucho trouble. The point is, we don't know how long they were in the Garden of Eden. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. How much time? It isn't dated, it isn't timed. And as a matter of fact, what happened here was that historically, theologians assumed that statement was a summary statement. In other words, the way they read it was, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and in the next 31 verses, I'm going to tell you exactly and precisely everything about how, when, where, and why he did it. But folks, that's not what it says. This is a historical narrative written in a historical sequence. In the beginning, something happened. What happened? God created the heaven, the Shekin, the heaved up things, and the earth. What happened next? The earth was, or some translations say became, without form and void. What happened next? The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. What happened next? God said, let there be light. This isn't a summary statement. This is a series of events. And I'll show you later on that they fit the evidence perfectly. The point is that Usher's assumption is wrong. Usher says, I'm going to assume that there are no missing people in the genealogies of the Bible. You may remember that back in the first presentation, we talked about one of the mistakes that atheists make in assuming that there are biblical contradictions when different cultures write things in different ways. It's important to understand that when genealogies are given in the Bible, the culture that wrote it had a purpose in it. And if you compare Ezra 7, for example, beginning with verse 3, with 1 Chronicles 6, beginning with verse 6, they both give the genealogy from Zechariah to Amariah, but Ezra does it in 4 steps and Chronicles does it in 10 steps. And we pointed out in our discussion back in the first presentation that if you compare Luke and Matthew, there's a huge difference. 42 steps from Abraham to Jesus in Matthew and 57 in Luke. The point is that this is not an American book written in an American style of writing. So as we pointed out in the first presentation in this series, when Matthew 1:1 says, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, we understand that was a Jewish system, and it is not saying that Abraham was Jesus' grandpa. It's important to look at who wrote it, why they wrote it, who they wrote it to, and how the people of the time would have understood it. The point then is that no person knowing the Jewish culture and the Jewish language would suggest that you could use the genealogies to calculate the age of the earth. Usher said, I'm going to assume that the genealogies are all chronological. Well, that's not true. Noah's sons are given backwards. Usher said, I'm going to assume there are no historical periods missing from the Bible. That's not true. How about Malachi to Matthew? And the most significant point is, Usher said, I'm assuming that the genealogies were written for chronological purposes. And that is absolutely not the case. They were not written for chronological purposes. They were to indicate descendancy. So what's my point in all this discussion? My point is the Bible doesn't tell us the age of the earth. That simply is not the purpose for which the Bible has given us its history. And it's interesting to look at people in the older times who had studied this. David Lipscomb, who I regard as one of the most honest and one of the most interesting earlier writers in church history and Protestantism in the United States, and particularly in the Restoration Movement, said, quote, I have no way of knowing how long the world was created before man was created. The Bible does not tell. It only says, in the beginning, and that afterward he created the plants and the animals and last of all man, but it gives no intimation how long the earth was created before these other things. Foy E. Wallace, who was certainly one of the most conservative writers in the early Restoration Movement and who stated things just very openly, said it more clearly than anything I've ever seen. There is no statement, he says, in the Bible which indicates the age of the earth. That's my point. If the scientists or the pseudoscientists want to ascribe to the earth the age of a million or billion or 300 billion, I will not pose to argue in the beginning God. That is all the Bible affirms on the question. Absolutely. The Bible is not a clock. That's not its purpose. And it's important for us, if we are going to take the Bible literally, to not add a denominational tradition to what the Bible has to say. I don't know the age of the earth. And what's more, I don't care. The God I believe in is so powerful he could have created the earth 2 minutes ago in the middle of that last sentence. With you sitting there listening to me sitting here doing what I'm doing, he didn't need a week or 6,000 years or 6 billion years. He could have done it in no time at all. The next question is, okay, if the Bible doesn't say that, what does it say? And is it accurate? And that's our next lesson. What is the actual statement of Genesis and how does it match the evidence?